This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Kyle Dargan is here. He has a new book, and this fascinating book is about a realization that takes place in him that is going to change a lot of readers. But first, a poem from another book. Here's Kyle.
State of the Union. I live in a land called East of the River, 5 miles from the U.S. Capitol, where airspace must still be policed, no fly zones. Tonight, a helicopter freezes into a shallow star blinking above my house, while the men and women of government herd themselves inside the Senate chambers, our commander-in-chief and all his cabinet, save one, traditionally one, who is excluded and tasked with waiting to resurrect our country should Iran, Russia, China, or what's left of Iraq try to bowl a ballistic 7-10 split, toppling the monument and capital. Tonight, it's our agriculture secretary's duty to save us. It should always be our agriculture secretary. In times of crisis, a country needs, before commerce or war or law, to eat. And if Congress has allowed the appointment of an agriculture secretary who can't grow a pea, might we not deserve oblivion? I prefer to imagine our Secretary of Agriculture hunkered in his undisclosed location, listening to the speech on battery-powered radio, sifting seed through his dusty palms, deciding what must grow first in the aftermath of fire.
Kyle Dargan, now you know what he's all about. I am so glad you read that poem because that tells a lot about you.
Thank you, and thank you for having me back.
And what is the title of that book? That's a book we know.
Yeah, that's Honest Engine, and there's a lot of D.C. in that book, and there's even more D.C. in the new book, so I try to be a D.C. writer in that way.
And you are, and you're with American University. You're a well-known writer and a new dad. So Kyle has in his hand another book, which is just premiering, and I want you to tell us the name.
The title is Anagnorisis, and what it refers to, if we're talking about elements of classic tragedy, Greek tragedy, is the moment when the tragic hero comes to some sort of realization of the true nature of his situation or dilemma, saying his, since most tragic heroes were mostly male, but doesn't have to be. And the word also sort of translates into recognition, so a recognition for such a figure as well. And for me, I think the 2016 election and the year sort of leading up to that moment was a big moment for recognition as an adult for myself. And that's sort of what informs the title and the way the book moves.
And Kyle, you have always been an activist, a poet warrior. You've always told a truth that nobody else sees. And so this book, where you double down even more, is really beyond powerful. But what happened in you that was the turning point in a Greek hero where they learn all of a sudden something new about themselves? Because you always, in all of your poetry, seem to know exactly who you are and what you believe. What more happened to you?
Well, remember, like, these are tragic heroes, right? So the tragic element, I would say, is that I had a certain belief in the people around me and a certain belief that they wouldn't allow certain things to happen, be that politically, be that culturally. You know, you always thought that there was some sort of wall or a bulwark against, like, crossing a certain line. And I feel like for a lot of people, we're in a space that we never thought we would be in their lifetimes, in modern times.
And you wrote a book about it, and that's what this book is.
Yeah.
And do you believe that you have said what you wanted to say?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's hear it.
Okay.
Let's hear a poem. Kyle Dargan has said what he wanted to say. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress.
So this poem is titled Daily Conscription. It opens with the epigraph from James Baldwin, which is, "We can no longer afford that particular romance." Daily Conscription. Brother Ricky halts me before I cross East Capitol. He trumpets that we are at war. I want to admit that I don't believe in white, in the manner that Baldwin did not. But Brother Ricky would simply retort that my disbelief is no immunity from the imaginations of those who think themselves white. As we await the spotlight shift, so I may walk and he may holler, "Final call!" between lanes of idle traffic. I think of race as something akin to climate change, a force we don't have to believe in for it to undo us. I once believed in the seasons. I fantasized fall as Brother Ricky's favorite, when his suits, boxy and plaid, would be neither too hot nor too thin. But we are losing spring and fall, tripping from blaze to frost and back. And what's to say we won't soon shed another season, one of those remaining two, and live on an earth of molten streets or one of frozen light? That's when worlds end, no. When, after we've eradicated ourselves, we become faint fossils to be exhumed by the curiosities of whatever life forms follow our reign. I still owe Brother Ricky $2 for the paper he last placed in my hand, calling me soldier. I don't have to believe that I am enlisted in order to understand he'll forgive my debt, so long as his idea of whiteness sorties above us, ultraviolet, obliging and aseasonal, unending deployment. Released by the signal, I advance, my head down, straining to discern the crossfire from the cover.
So when you feel the crush, instead of going to write a dystopian novel, you stand up and say, losing spring and fall, but you still owe him $2. Life goes on, and it seems like you've made your statement. Do you feel you've made your statement?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I understand contemplating the dystopian future as a necessary escape for people, or also as a warning, right? I understand the value in that. But I also think now, with the stakes being so high in the current moment, that maybe we've sort of reached the limit of the value of dystopia. Like maybe the future that we feared is in the far future is actually upon us, and that we need to do something different.
And doing something different is to read another poem, because Kyle, you make a difference. So please do read another poem from that book.
Okay.
It gives me courage.
I appreciate that, and helps me keep writing these pieces. This poem is titled 34. The cypress trees I planted after I bought the dead woman's house sway higher than me, even taller than the out-of-work chimney. And the neighbor, Miss Miller, who watched me wedge up crepe myrtles in favor of then knee-high evergreens, she has died. The stressed myrtles withered but lived once replanted in a hedgerow behind the Japanese maple. I drench them daily. Now they sing a steady emerald harmony, backing the maple's burgundy croon. Yes, there are days, say today, when I am fine suspending here my journey of breathing. Not a final capitulation, just ready. When question of what more arises, only when. Ambition, though, remains an antagonizing allergen, and my body secretes Will's mucus throughout my day's work. I never learned from Charles Wright the sage way a poet pulls poems out of their somber descents. Maybe I'm not sufficiently worn by this world, not old enough, what everyone tells me. But then explain that to my palms, to my souls, to the cypress fronds that fan above me, blatant in their surprise that I am still here.
Your journey of breathing, explain this to my palms. Where did you get that line?
I used to be a landscaper when I was younger professionally, and some of it on my own. So one of the things I always remember from that work is the feeling of sinking the shovel into the ground and the shock that it sort of sends back up through your palms and into your forearms. So
that is what this book does. I am so glad that line jumped out at me. It does go back. It explain this to the palms. You are hearing the reverb of these poems. Yes, one more from this book, and then we'll know what you're about.
Okay.
It's a pretty good testament to your stand right now in history. But you know, art does nothing, right? We all know that. And yet, when I read this book, I knew we were going to be okay.
I appreciate that. So I'll try to read another DC poem, since I don't think there's enough DC poetry.
Do you think DC poets don't write about DC?
No, I think we do. I just don't think the rest of the literary landscape of the nation really pays attention to what the DC writers are doing. And I think they're doing amazing work.
I think it's the third poetry capital in the world.
I think we all understand that here. So this poem is White Bread Blues. The Islander on U Street will be shuttered, says the Metro section of the Washington Post. I had my first and last plate of their curry bird after Heroes Are Gang Leaders played at Howard. Can I be sad? I think I've made my peace with gentrification. I tell myself market value, all it is, not race. Then there's no bitter echo within my skull. Mm. Georgia Avenue, Shaw on up to Florida Avenue, these days glimmers with eateries and wellness studios. Donnie Simpson's son owns a bakery atop the Metro. That's music. That's America, I guess. I stopped somewhere for a sandwich, which is why I'm writing this poem. Maybe gentrification is paying $13 for some catfish on brioche that tastes too sweet and lacks the structural integrity of whatever hard-fried fare you could carry from the dingy storefronts that dared to make a dollar when the afterbirth of riots was all that clung upon the streets. I tried walking and eating, but a tempura catfish sandwich shakes the bits when you pass in front of Howard University Hospital, where all the healed Bamas bop out the door styled like Batman villains if Gotham was Detroit instead of Manhattan, their skins embroidered with question marks. Everyone needs a place to be strange, or a city where you know what will and won't leave you hungry.
The voice of Kyle Dargan. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. You're really right, because not only do we have the abundance of poetry, but there is a profile in Washington. It is like the Harlem Renaissance is, the residue is here. The end of the Harlem Renaissance is here, and it's thriving. And I actually never put my finger on it until you said it that way. I always knew it was different, but it is really different.
Yeah.
It is significant. Kyle, there is one poem I do want you to read in this book, because it's about our mutual vulnerability. Abilities. And it's about the couple on the street you see, and you're sort of afraid to go out in the street, and then you think they're just going home. Do you know which poem that is?
Yeah, well, that's a longer prose passage.
Well, maybe just the last part of it then.
I can read part of it. So, I mean, it sort of details a walk I had in Southeast DC with a friend of mine, and sort of navigating that space of, at the same time, as you said, being thought of as a threat, but also encountering what, you know, you never know might be a threat. So I'll start after I've talked a bit about all of what you've mentioned. I resolve at age 33 that I'm no longer in the gray area between youth and adulthood, that in the physical and psychological battle for our community, I'm not a below-the-radar neutral party. I'm on the same side as Mr. Purcell and Miss Outlaw. And though my assessment of the situation I'm about to walk into suggests there is no certainty that these boys pose no threat, I decide that Kristen and I will walk right past them. If the two boys were Caucasian, I wouldn't even be engaged in this internal deliberation. This is also a useless point, because the only pair of Caucasian men I ever see walk the streets our uniformed officers. I quietly pull my keychain from my pocket and tuck the serrated shaft of the longest sigil between my fisted index and middle finger. Just as we approach the intersection where we will meet the boys on the other side, Kristen pulls my hand. Come on, let's cross the street. I do not feel relieved. In fact, I feel defeated as we cut diagonally through the street and the boys eye us. I see, no, I imagine they are smirking. At the corner where we would have met them, the boys don't cross the street. They open the gate of the row house on the corner, then trot up the walkway and inside. They were merely trying to get home, just like Kristen and me, just like, for all we'll know, Michael Brown.
I find that to be a very important part of your book. Do you think so?
Yeah, I mean, it manages to transition between sort of the initial writing about America and D.C. and China, because, you know, so much of that moment, that particular interaction, sort of speaks to like the really heightened state we were towards the end of the Obama years, with the relationship between the publicly broadcast relationship between the police and African-Americans. And I wondered, you know, leaving, and in a way, leaving for China felt like a release from that, because I didn't expect that, you know, I would be receiving that kind of energy that far across the globe. But in other ways, I did. And yeah, sort of bringing that.
Tell us about you in China and what it means to you and how it felt being a Black man in China as compared to America.
Right. So I guess what you realize is most of what they understand about Black masculinity in China is what they receive from Western media. So in some ways, you're very much a spectacle, right? And in other ways, you're very frightening. So on an average day for me, I could, you know, walk past the basketball courts and all the men would go crazy asking me to come join them. But at the same time, I could walk into a store, you know, in the evening and the, you know, female shopkeeper might scream and run to the back of the store because she thought I was in there to.
I didn't find that in the book.
Yeah, I kept that out because I'm still sort of working on, you know, my own feelings around those experiences.
And also, I believe that may not have been the principal thing you felt there.
No, I mean, I definitely felt more like, because the other thing is, too, what I don't get is like when you're Black abroad and you're American versus African, you have American privilege. And that's one thing I noticed. I noticed the way they treated me versus the way they treated Africans.
I've heard that.
And so while I had American privilege of sort of like being
American
the cool
privilege.
American, I was also dark skinned. So it was a conscious, you know.
A cool American. Let's have another poem. Let's have one about China.
Okay.
I like the way you tried to learn the language, though. And do you think you have accomplished a little bit? You've been more than once.
Yeah, I've been twice.
And what were you doing there?
It was cultural outreach. So the University of Iowa, they have the International Writing Program.
Oh, right.
And so they bring the writers to America and then writers go over there. Although this time it was purely sponsored by the Chinese Writers Association. And I was over there. And I basically go because I know if I don't go, it's probably a good chance a lot of those people will never meet an African-American. And so I, you know, that's why I figure it's good that I go, because they could, if they're going to ask one American writer, right, you know, I should go, especially when Obama was in office. I remember, because what's interesting is the younger people are, of course, more versed in English than sort of the older people. And so there'd be lots of interactions. Like, say I went to a store and the older shopkeeper, like, we can sort of get by with a little pigeon, but the younger child would be able to talk. And I remember once I went to a store and I had to talk to the younger child because the father couldn't speak to me.
Uh-huh.
And when I left, I walked out the store, the father was sort of pointing at me and he was saying, "Obama, Obama." So I think, you know, there are moments like that are part of why I went. So this is the shouts of Tanggu Station. And just to say it so towards the ending, so in China, or Mandarin, thank you is xie xie, and more formally is xie xie ni, which is thank you. Ni is thank you. So the shouts of Tanggu Station. My weak ear for the lilts of Mandarin speech does not spare me. I hear the parched yao's mouth by the indigent old man bedded on Tanggu Station's stairwell. Meguo, Meguo, he groans, lifting his beggar's bowl without a qingwen or duebuqi. He is not blind. Still, I wonder how he knows I am no Ethiopian, Dominican, Carib, or any of the other bloods my skin is often mistaken to carry. While I weave through the clouds of grilling squid outside the Tanggu entrance, a boy leans out hollows from his car. Hey, amigo. I nod, relented to his eagerness. Why bother working the loom of cerebral lobes, weaving the phrase, bu amigo, washer megwaren? I'm so far from believing our voices might merge like highway traffic on Jingtong's roads. On the walk home, I stop for practice paper. She she, I thank the shopkeeper. She she ni, she corrects me.
The voice of Kyle Dorrigan reading from his new book, say the title again.
Anagnorisis.
And did you just come across that in your reading, or how did that find you?
No, it's actually something I've been thinking about for a while, because when I first got to American, you know, you sort of teach the lower classes, and we had a class called Literary Imagination where you basically looked at a bunch of genres. And I always taught Death of a Salesman, because I think that's a really, you know, important play for understanding America, you know. And one of the ways that I would look at Death of a Salesman, and so much for me about teaching writing is getting people to understand how it works structurally. You know, I think there's so much emphasis just on like interpretation or like what's happening. But I feel like if you really understand writing, you understand how the writer was able to have that, you know, or sort of like bring that effect, that feeling out of you. So one of the ways in which I would look at Death of a Salesman is I was like study it through the classic, you know, Greek elements of tragedy. Because I do think of Death of a Salesman as a tragic play. You know, I think of Willie Loman as a tragic hero. So in doing that, you know, so we would sort of go through those points and sort of ask, like, well, do we have a reversal here? Do we have, you know, hubris here? You know, do we have? And so it was a really great way to get the students engaged, because there's no set answers to that. Like, it's not a Greek tragedy. So when you bring those elements to the play, it's an open conversation for the students. Like, well, does this play work as a Greek tragedy, or doesn't it? And one of the turns, of course, that you sort of look for is that revelation. So I think, you know, for Willie Loman, there's that revelation where, and it's also an interesting moment. This moment happens. He's his father's friends, and you know, he's successful and Happy isn't. And he has this sort of, you know, revelation, because, you know, Willie's always wondering, like, well, why is it that, you know, other people are, you know, getting what they want, but not me? Like, what is it? And of course, he doesn't make a proper assessment of his life, but he sort of like comes to some realization that there's something that I can do. It's not an external thing, it's an internal thing. He just makes a bad internal choice in deciding to kill himself. But yeah, so that's how I got interested in the idea of anagnorisis.
How did you get the way you are?
No idea. I mean, living in America, it makes us all a little bit crazy, and also extra perceptive in some ways.
And maybe a flash of genius. I should tell them who you are. Yes, he was the director. I don't know if you're still the director of creative writing or
assistant
not.
Director now.
Okay. But you have been heading it for a few years, and that is creative writing at American University, and you are the founder and editor of Post No Ills magazine. You also are the author of 4 collections of poetry, and you've worked with Kaveh Khanum. You've received their poetry prize, I think.
Fortunately,
and
yeah.
The Hurston Wright Legacy Award and grants from the D.C. Commission on the Arts. Your books have been finalists for the greatest prizes in America, and surely they will be seen as the prize winner in a very short time. Kyle Dorrigan, there are new poems here, mm-hmm. and they look so different in form. And I'm going to ask you to read one of them.
Okay.
And what happened to you that got you into couplets?
Well, I mean, I feel like couplets are sort of like learning your scales if you're a musician, right? So you can, so I return to couplets every now and again just to sort of like get my footing in whatever it is. If I'm working on something new and then decide later, always ask myself the question. I tell my students to ask themselves the question, does this really need to be in couplets?
I always think couplets are there to really contain a lot of tumult.
Mm-hmm.
So let's hear the tumult.
All right. This is Separating. Opens with an epigraph from Audre Lorde, which is, there is blood in the morning egg that makes me turn and weep. Between the work at work and the work at home, I rush inside a grocery store to buy the bits for quick breakfast that leave me hungry by the time I return to my office. It's an organic market, and as I shop, I can hear my mother, her mouth full of pennies, mocking each cent I overpay for staples. But time's expense burns black holes in pockets, so no detour to a cheaper store. So honey priced like wine, so 6 eggs for what would buy 12, all in the name of time. It will be days before I have a moment when I can pause my pre-commute to click on the electric kettle, boil water for steeping rooibos and poaching eggs. Eventually, I reach inside the refrigerator, revisit the words cage-free, pasture-raised, which, in my earlier haste, read like gibberish strings of dollar signs. When I crack open the brown pods, what glops into the ramekin is a yolk yellow so plump and lucent. I tear up, thinking of all the weak or sallow suns I have dropped into water, of the stressed existences that made those eggs. What of my thin shell or my own yolk unbroken within me, both functions of money, time, deficits? And I know nothing about industrial farms, and I understand so much of blackness as what I do in spite of my caging. But I know I cannot buy another egg not laid by a bird I believed foraged, walked freely under the sun, deciding how to value her motion, her blood. A bourgeois privilege, I know, but if not to make that choice, why else am I grinding myself down for these wages?
Kyle, cage-free, that is so lyrically beautiful. I've never heard couplets that become pure lyric. That is a real high point for you.
Thank you.
Does your mother with her mouth full of pennies, what does that mean?
I think every once in a while you just have to get weird in a poem.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. But I mean, it means so much to me.
No,
it means many things
right,
to me.
I mean, in some ways, I mean, like if I was to think about what it would sound like for my mother to chide me about my purchases.
I know, that's what I got.
It would.
That's what I got. But just only you would say that, my mother with her mouth full of pennies, and we understand it's about your purchases. Kyle, where did you, what happened? Were you reading as a child? Was your father James Baldwin? I mean.
I wish, no.
Tell me where you got this ability.
My grandmother, who mostly raised me, I wasn't in daycare, I was with my grandmother. She lived a very interesting life. She was a Broadway performer and she was a police officer. She was the first black woman detective in the history of Newark, New Jersey. She was also in Carmen Jones, the original Broadway production.
Did I miss a poem about that?
I had some poems about that I lost in the hard drive a couple of years ago.
You can restore them. You can redo it.
Maybe.
We won her. We won her.
Well, she left me lots of papers, and she was always a reader, too. She was a big reader. She was the person that modeled reading for me. So I think her interest, because my mother and my father, they're mostly just kind of like hardworking people. You know, they do their jobs, and they come home, and they... And she was the one who had sort of kind of traveled and, you know, lived a different life. So I think her raising me and sort of bringing me up in part in her world just opened up a lot of my curiosity.
What's her name?
Her name is Ruth Dargan. Ruth.
Ruth Dargan. This beer is for you, Ruth. This program's for you. That is great. Let us have a closing poem.
Okay. So we can do the longer piece?
I'd love the one about your father.
Okay. And this is a run-in title, so the first line is the title. For the man who caught my father, when he lilted, lost in fainting, and careened off the bar stool, dear catcher, dear hands, I pray you know this is not another story about a dad and liquor. You know something about my father, even I do not, his weight and plummet, and the necessary force to keep his shoulders from plowing into the floor or his temple from tasting the chrome legs of the stool beside him. As it stands, This is a tale of a man with bones well trod by tobacco and hard spirits. I have been a character in this story you have now saved. Call me the one who crawled free from ash swells, who was not whiskey drowned, who would leave home to alight from trains in towns where none knew his damp, cigarette-tinged skin. Kissing the phone screen against my cheek, I tried to deduce the cause of my father's fall. A doctor 1 month prior, what I know, which you did not, snaked a balloon through my father's arteries so hard they collapsed. A stent left as scaffolding in the unstable blood shaft. I fathom he maybe lowered himself awkwardly upon the seat, with his thigh spilling over the edge, the mesh holding his peripheral artery open to blood instead pinched narrow. What the doctor feared when he ordered, "No more racquetball for you." Couldn't that drive a man to seek a pity drink? To grab a seat at the bar, ergonomics be damned, and his blood pressure sinking? You held my father until the ambulance held him, and then the hospital let him go. Tests cleared. And I can only ponder any of that. I can only write this now at a distance, at ease, because you, dear arms, snapped open that human preservation reflex and embraced his payload, which, had it crashed, would have made a crypt of me.
The voice of Kyle Dargan. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation, with additional support by the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.